The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'm delighted to be here, and I'm delighted to be talking about a man who was, well, delightful. You can say a lot of things about Louis Armstrong, and that's why I wrote a book about him. But if you have the good fortune to speak to anyone who knew him personally, be it casually or intimately, you can bet that they'll all tell you the same thing. He was a truly lovable man. I've spent most of my life in the company of artists, and one thing I can tell you is that the greatest ones tend not to be especially lovable. Likeable, yes, sometimes. Charismatic, yes, sometimes. And not infrequently irresistible, for it's part of human nature for us ordinary people to want to warm our hands at the fire of a great creator. But those fires are very hot indeed, and I've known any number of people who got badly burned as a result of keeping company with greatness. Louis Armstrong was different. He was a great man who was also a good man, kind and generous and considerate. And unlike many good men, he wasn't even slightly boring. He was utterly unpretentious. He didn't talk in pompous clichés. He loved to laugh and knew how to make other people laugh. And on top of that, he was the greatest jazz musician who ever lived. Armstrong was one of the cultural giants of the 20th century. America has never produced a more significant artist. I rank him right alongside Aaron Copland and Robert Frost and Frank Lloyd Wright. But unlike those men, he was also a great entertainer whose music was and is loved by ordinary people all over the world. In 1964, he actually knocked the Beatles off the top of the pop charts with his recording of Hello, Dolly. Aaron Copland never did that. Now you can see why I was drawn to the idea of writing the biography of so singular a creature as Satchmo, or Pops, as his friends called him. Needless to say, I'm not the first person to have done so, but I am the first biographer to have had access to 650 reel-to-reel tapes that Armstrong made during the last quarter century of his life, many of which contain astonishingly candid recordings of his private after-hours conversations. Armstrong switched on his tape recorder whenever the spirit moved him. You can hear him chatting with friends over dinner, getting high with an old pal in his dressing room after a show, even trying to coax his wife into bed at 5 a.m. for a little hanky-panky. Not only do these tapes shine a bright light on his personality, which was far more complex than most people realize, but they also make it possible for us to know the full stories of such key moments in his life as his 1930 marijuana arrest. That's a big part of what made me want to write Pops. Nowadays, most folks know me as a drama critic, but as you heard, I'm also a trained musician. The first one, in fact, ever to write a fully sourced Armstrong biography. I started out as a professional jazz musician, a bass player, before becoming a full-time writer. And I think that experience has helped me to understand Armstrong's music and the world in which he lived and worked from the inside out. In Pops, I've tried to translate that knowledge into plain English and weave it into the incredible story of Armstrong's life. As Duke Ellington said, he was born poor, died rich, and never hurt anyone on the way. But how did he work that miracle? In the course of writing Pops, I came to feel that Armstrong's triumph was as much a function of his personality as of his musical genius. If you don't understand the one, you won't understand the other. And it is Armstrong's personality to which I want to introduce you now. So let us start in the best possible way by watching him at work. What you are about to see is an excerpt from the earliest surviving film of Louis Armstrong on stage. It was shot in Copenhagen in 1933. He's singing and playing Dinah with a band of musicians from Europe. You'll like to know this. I just got back from the Comcast Center, where I saw the Christmas Spectacular, And this isn't quite as fancy as that, but I think you'll find it's at least as entertaining. So if you would you play the video, please? That's the Louis Armstrong who took the world by storm in the 20s and 30s, the public Armstrong. In Pops, I take you backstage to meet the private Armstrong, for there is more to Louis Armstrong, much more than most people know. Though he was known the world over for his million-volt smile, Armstrong was a tough-minded, realistic man who always knew the score, whether it was about race relations or the music business or anything else. He loved to tell tales about his life, and he told them very, very well. For he was not just a gifted musician, but a gifted writer. Tallulah Bankhead, one of his biggest fans, said that he uses words like he strings notes together, artistically and vividly. Armstrong strung his words together very neatly indeed when he told the story of his encounter with a gun-toting Chicago gangster in 1931. He was working at a mobbed-up nightclub called the Showboat when what he described as a big, badass hood named Frankie Foster came backstage after the show and told him that he'd be playing in New York City the next night. Armstrong said, "I already have a gig in Chicago." And Foster pulled his pistol, cocked it, and stuck it in Armstrong's ribs. Here is how Armstrong described what happened next. He said, "Jesus, it looked like a cannon and sounded like death. So I look down at that steel and I say, well, maybe I do open in New York tomorrow." I tried to get that side of Armstrong into Pops as well, because it's as much a part of him as his genius. Joe Glazer, his manager, once said that Armstrong was a real, real man. He reminds me of something that my namesake, the Roman playwright Terence, wrote 2,000 years ago. "I am a man and nothing is alien to me." Louis Armstrong was a real man, and nothing was alien to him, and he turned it all good and bad, into music. Now I'm going to read you part of the prologue to Pops, in which I try to convey Armstrong's personality in words. And so now, here is an excerpt from Pops, The Life of Louis Armstrong. Everyone who knew Armstrong agreed that he was what he seemed to be. "What you saw was what you got," said Joe Maraney, who played clarinet in his band, the All-Stars. Jack Bradley, a photographer whom Armstrong befriended in the 60s, described him as down-to-earth, natural, completely unpretentious, simple in the best sense of the word. It was his genuineness as much as his genius to which his fans responded. He once reacted to a radio interviewer's pronouncement that he was a living American legend by dropping his pants and giggling. "I don't care what company I'm in, what environment, you know," he said on another occasion. "I just want to be there and enjoy it, just as good as the average cat." Whether on stage or off, he was the embodiment of Johnny Mercer's admonition in Accentuate the Positive: "You've got to spread joy up to the maximum, keep gloom down to the minimum." Danny Barker, the New Orleans guitarist, saw him in his dressing room after a show and remembered the sight ever after. This is what he wrote. "He'd be sitting down in his underwear with a towel around his lap, one around his shoulders, and that white handkerchief on his head, and he put that grease around his lips, looked like a minstrel man, you know, and laughing, you know, natural, the way he is. And in the room, you see maybe two nuns. You see a streetwalker dressed all up in flaming clothes. You see maybe a guy come out of the penitentiary. You see maybe a blind man sitting there. You see a rabbi. You see a priest, see? Liable to see maybe two policemen or detectives. You see a judge. All of them different levels of society in the dressing room, and he'd be talking to all of them. And there'd be some kids there, white and colored. All the diverse people of different social levels, and everybody's looking, got their eyes dead on him, just like they was looking at a diamond." He was, of course, the least average of cats, though his place in the history of jazz is harder to explain than is commonly understood. Armstrong did not invent jazz, nor was he its first significant figure, and it's not even right to call him the first great jazz soloist, as many critics and scholars have done. Sidney Bechet, the New Orleans clarinetist who was 4 years his senior, preceded him by a decade, while Bix Beiderbecke started winning national recognition at the same time as Armstrong, almost to the month. What then made Louis Armstrong stand out, and why is his name known to those who know nothing else about jazz? The simplest explanation, and up to a point the best one, is that he was the first great influence in jazz. No sooner did he burst upon the scene than other musicians, trumpeters, saxophonists, singers, started imitating him. "I tried to walk like him, talk like him, eat like him, sleep like him," said Rex Stewart, who replaced Armstrong in Fletcher Henderson's band. Coleman Hawkins, Henderson's star saxophonist, heard him for the first time in 1924 and was stunned into speechlessness. He remembered, "I stood silent, feeling almost bashful, asking myself if I would ever be able to attain a small part of Louis Armstrong's greatness." The trumpeter Max Kaminski told of how the combination of Louis's dazzling virtuosity and sensational brilliance of tone so overwhelmed me that I felt as if I had stared into the sun's eye. Such imagery came easily to those who heard Armstrong in his halcyon days. The poet Philip Larkin, a part-time jazz critic and lifelong fan, praised him in similar terms, calling him something inexhaustible and unchanging, like the sun. Even Miles Davis, who loathed Armstrong's clowning, knew that the history of jazz radiated outward from the bell of his horn. He said, "You can't play nothing on trumpet that doesn't come from him. I can't even remember a time when he sounded bad playing the trumpet. Never." What spoke to these artists, as it speaks to all those hearing Armstrong for the first time, is the combination of hurtling momentum and expansive lyricism that propelled his playing and singing alike. The four staccato quarter notes that he raps out at the start of West End Blues, his most celebrated recording, proclaimed the coming of a new way of thinking about rhythm. Though the passage looks simple enough on paper, it catapulted his fellow jazzmen into a musical world in which even the simplest of phrases were charged with an irresistible forward thrust. To be sure, his internal metronome was exact enough to impress the most fanatically rhythmatical of jazz musicians. Herbert von Karajan once told the members of the Vienna Philharmonic that he was going to an All-Stars concert. "Imagine," he said, 2 hours of music, and never once will it slow down or speed up by mistake." But Armstrong could also toy with time, stretching it this way and that, as he does in the serene trumpet solo that ends his 1933 recording of Harold Arlen's "I Got a Right to Sing the Blues," hovering miles above the clockwork tyranny of the beat and sounding, for all the world, like a lordly turn-of-the-century grand opera tenor. The comparison is apt, for Armstrong liked, listened to, and learned from opera. He said, "I like that deep stuff also. It gasses me to no end." Said that to Orson Welles. Late in life, he remembered buying his first record player, a wind-up Victrola, as a teenager in New Orleans. He remembered, "Most of my records were the original Dixieland Jazz Band, but I had Caruso, too, and Henry Burr, Gallic Kirchy, Tetrazzini. They were all my favorites. Then there was the Irish tenor, John McCormick." Beautiful phrasing. But his style was also permeated with the rough beauty of the blues, and if it was his way to sing and play them with a smile, he knew as well as anyone that the world of which he sang could be a hurtful place. "Like when I play maybe back of town blues, I'm thinking about one of the old lowdown moments when maybe your woman didn't treat you right. That's a hell of a moment when a woman tell you, I got another mule in my stall." Even the classical melodies he loved took on a new tint when passed through the prism of his vast experience. "I seen everything from a child coming up," he said. "Nothing happened I ain't never seen before." He was forever reflecting on the things he had seen, sometimes on paper, but more often with his horn. "When I blow," he said, "I think of times and things from out of the past that gives me an image of the tune, like moving pictures passing in front of my eyes, a town, a chick somewhere back down the line, an old man with no name you seen once in a place you don't remember." That was why he never used musical terminology when speaking of his music. It was all about life. These are but a few of the myriad facets of Armstrong's art, and one can go a long way toward understanding him without mentioning anything else. But it is not enough to declare him a phenomenally gifted and imaginative artist and let it go at that. The other reason why he cast so long a shadow is that his personality was as compelling as his artistry. The two could scarcely be separated, for his lavish generosity of spirit was part and parcel of his prodigal way of making music. Even in his old age, he held nothing back, and it seemed at times that nothing was beyond him. He really did perform with everyone from Leonard Bernstein to Johnny Cash. He really did end his concerts, some of them anyway, by playing 250 or more high C's, capped with a high F. He wrote the finest of jazz autobiographies, Satchmo, My Life in New Orleans, without a collaborator. The ranks of his admirers included Kingsley Amis, Jackson Pollock, Jean Renoir, and Le Corbusier. The composer Virgil Thompson called him a master of musical art. Stuart Davis, whose abstract paintings were full of jazz-inspired images, cited him as a model of greatness. Is it any wonder, then, that so many musicians longed to play the way he played and sing the way he sang? It was no accident that they usually referred to Armstrong not as Satchmo, his own favorite nickname, but as Pops. He was the father figure of jazz, and what his children wanted was to be him, or at least come as close as they possibly could. Why did Armstrong spend so many hours scribbling on a pad or hunched over a typewriter? Partly because he was a gregarious man who enjoyed sending chatty letters to his friends and fans, but also because he believed that he had something of value to tell the world. Having been born desperately poor, he had worked desperately hard, first as a boy and then as a man. In this, he had much in common with Ragged Dick, Horatio Alger's plucky bootblack, whose burning desire to grow up respectable propelled him into the ranks of the middle class. Self-discipline, self-improvement, self-reliance, these were his lifelong watchwords, and no Alger hero could have improved on his iron determination to get ahead in the world. Once he did so, he felt an obligation to tell others how to do the same. I was determined to play my horn against all odds, and I had to sacrifice a whole lot of pleasure to do so, he wrote in Satchmo. A few years later, he made the point more pungently in a TV interview in which he said, "The Lord will help the poor, but not the poor lazy." While most jazz musicians, black and white alike, now come from relatively comfortable backgrounds, those who are born poor have almost always striven mightily to join the middle class. Anyone who doubts that Armstrong filled the latter bill need only visit his home, located 7 blocks from Shea Stadium in a run-down but respectable part of Queens. It is a 3-story brick-covered frame house whose interior is reminiscent of Graceland, Elvis Presley's gaudy Memphis mansion. From the Jetson-style kitchen of the future to the silver wallpaper and golden faucets of the master bathroom, the Armstrong house looks like what it is, the residence of a poor boy who cast down his bucket and pulled it up overflowing. Unlike Graceland, though, the house is neither oppressive nor embarrassing, and as you stand in the smallish study, whose decorations include a portrait of the artist painted by Tony Bennett, it is impossible not to be touched by the aspiration visible wherever you look. This, it is clear, was the home of a working man, bursting with a pride that came not from what he had, but what he did. "I never want to be anything more than I am. What I have, I don't need," Armstrong wrote in his old age. "My home is good, but you don't see me in no big estates and yachts. That ain't gonna play your horn for you." In common with other self-made men, Armstrong sometimes forgot that his success was due not solely to work and pluck, but also to the talent with which he had been born. He was a man of boundless generosity who preached the stony gospel of individual responsibility, a ferociously ambitious artist who preferred, when he could, to do as he was told, an introspective man who exploded with irrepressible vitality when he stepped into the spotlight, a joyous genius who confounded his critics by refusing to distinguish between making art and making fun. No more than any other genius was he all of a piece. As Murray Kempton said, "He endures to mix in his own person all men, the pure and the cheap, clown and creator, god and buffoon." Yet all was resolved each time he raised his trumpet to his lips, for that was when the laughter stopped and the beauty began. He knew that, in his words, showmanship does not mean you're not serious. And no one who has read his writings can doubt that he was both serious and self-aware. He knew who he was, what he had done, and how far he had come, and was fiercely proud of it all. He admitted that his music mattered more to him than anything else, even his wives. He said, "When I pick up that horn, that's all. The world's behind me, and I don't concentrate on nothing but it. That my living and my life, I love them notes. That why I try to make 'em right. See?" The whole world saw and heard. So that's how my book starts. And now, if you don't mind, a few words of epilogue. I spent 5 years working on Pops. Especially in the past few months, a great many people have asked me something like this: "That's a lot of time to spend with anybody. Do you still like Armstrong? Do you still admire him? Or did you get sick and tired of him?" Now, that's an easy question to answer. Didn't get sick or tired of Louis Armstrong. I don't see how you could. He is that rarity of rarities, a great man who improves with exposure. The better you get to know him, the more you like him. This isn't to say that he wasn't a complicated personality, because he was, very much so. Offstage, he could be moody and profane. He had a habit of flying into red rages that he forgot all about the next day, and he knew how to hold a grudge. "I got a simple rule about everybody," he told a journalist. "If you don't treat me right, shame on you." But that's merely to say that Armstrong was a human being, as flawed as the next man. And if there's anything that I learned in the process of writing Pops, it is that Louis Armstrong's flaws were few and forgivable. In return for his unswerving dedication to his art, he knew true happiness and shared it unstintingly with his fellow men. Not long before he died, he told a friend that my whole life has been happiness. Through all of the misfortunes, etc., I did not plan anything. Life was there for me, and I accepted it. And life, whatever came out, has been beautiful to me, and I love everybody. Now, I can't top that. So I will let Pops have the last word. What you are now about to see is a TV performance of one of his favorite songs, On the Sunny Side of the Street, originally broadcast in 1958. It is my favorite film clip of Louis Armstrong, the one that says the most about who he was and what he did. And now the floor is yours. I would be more than happy to answer any questions that you might have about Louis Armstrong or about my book. We're bringing the house lights up so that I can point you out. Someone with a microphone will come and so everybody can hear you. So if you will raise your hand, I'll work my way around the room. And we got a gentleman right down here. Yes, sir.
You mentioned Joe Glazer, his manager for many years. I have read that Glazer put him on a terrific schedule, night after night, performing.
300 nights a year. Think about that.
My impression is that Glazer wanted him to produce a certain kind of music, and possibly kept him back from some of the more advanced changes in American music. In my opinion, but you're the expert, in my opinion, even if Glazer hadn't done that, he would not have changed the kind of music that he played.
I agree with you.
Some have argued that, for instance, he was very much opposed to bebop, etc., that if he had been let go, not have such a tight rein on him, he might have changed the kind of music that he played as the years went on. What is your opinion?
He made a couple of records right after the war. One of them is with a band that contains players who were experimenting with bebop. And he plays this very hip unison line. It's a record called Snafu. And as you listen to it, you hear a possibility that he chose not to embrace. He had it in him. He was a genius. But he played the music he wanted to play. What Glazer wanted him to do and what Armstrong wanted to do was to reach a mass audience with his art through its presentation. And so Glazer, you know, gets him into the movies. Glazer gets him onto the radio. Glazer puts him out there, tells him, you know, Lewis, people want to be entertained. Don't forget that. But you didn't have to tell him that. He wanted to entertain them. I think that's the heart of the matter. In the about four rows up from you.
I think it was said that Louis Armstrong in his days wasn't very understandable, and that people these days do not understand his music or him either. But I think that's a misinterpretation, because his jazz was known all over the world, and they knew exactly what he talked about and understood his music and was very heartfelt about it. And I'd just like to know that since all the musicians, including Louis Armstrong's music, put a trend setting on music today. I would like to know if Louis Armstrong put a trend setting on hip hop.
That's a good question. I can't answer that. I don't know. I mean, I've never heard any rapper talk specifically about being influenced by Louis Armstrong. But if you kind of pull the historical camera back, you're talking about a guy who really, in many ways, set the tone for all American popular music in the 20th century. He's the great influence. And, you know, maybe what he is the great grandfather of this kind of music, if you want to look at it that way. But the most important thing with him is that he wanted to be understood. He wanted to be clear and accessible to everybody. And, you know, when you saw that clip of him singing on the Sunny Side of the Street, which I love because it pulls right in, you're right on top of him. You know, how could anybody misunderstand that? That's music about joy. And Armstrong, as I say in my book, was a major key artist, fundamentally optimistic, even though he understood that the world could be a hell of a place. But he never let it beat him down. I think that's his message for us today, is what I think. Let's go over to the other side. To you, sir.
You mentioned that he played up to 300 nights a year.
Yeah.
Playing that much takes a huge toll on anybody's mouth and general health. How did he manage that? And did he at any time throughout his career have big breakdowns? And finally, did all of that contribute to his death? Because I know that he died of congestive heart failure. I'm just thinking of all that blowing against pressure might have been bad for his heart.
Well, I think red beans and rice contributed to his death, to tell you the truth. He had a very homemade diet. But let's talk about that. You got a chance to see a big close-up of Louis Armstrong. If you were looking, you saw how deeply scarred his upper lip is. He suffered from a condition called leukoplakia, which means that you form excess scar tissue. That's the reason why his voice sounds the way it does, because he has had nodes that were developed on his vocal cords. And also, Armstrong, he was not completely self-taught. You know, he had a year and a half of instruction at the Colored Waves Home in New Orleans. But he started playing the horn on his own, and he didn't have access to the kinds of sophisticated playing techniques that now allow trumpet players to play loud and play high and do it with physical effortlessness. And so because of these problems, he started having split lips. Really, he had his first split lip a couple of years after he started playing the instrument. And he had them at intervals throughout his life. You asked if there were times when he broke down completely. Yeah. In 1934, he had a major crisis, and he didn't play the horn for more than a year. He was just off the scene. He played more simply after that, less flashy technique. He cut his coat to fit his cloth. But in a way, it was productive for him, because when you're an artist in middle age and you're a genius, you usually simplify your language to get right to the heart of the matter. And that's what I hear in Armstrong's recordings of the 30s and 40s, is this special kind of simplicity of maturity. But sometimes he played the way he did because that night he couldn't play anything else. And the giveaway was always, when he was having lip trouble, less trumpet, more vocals. There's actually a film, there's a video cassette of him live in 1959, and you can hear him on a bad night. It's fascinating. But yeah, he had troubles, and he never quite got over them. Yes, all the way in the back, we have a hand and somebody with a hat, and that's all I can see from here. We should have a spotlight up here to pick you all out.
Thank you. Can you talk something, address his transition from cornet to trumpet? Mm-hmm. Did he ever play the flugelhorn, and was he capable of playing any other instruments?
Okay. First, I'll tell you, those of you who aren't brass players, a cornet is a smaller, stubbier, trumpet-like instrument with a different bore. It was invented in the 19th century for use in brass bands, and that was what Armstrong started playing as a boy in New Orleans. When he got to Chicago, he was playing in a movie house orchestra, and everybody else in the trumpet section had trumpets. They're longer, they're more brilliant. He wanted to look like them. So he got a trumpet, and he found that he liked the brilliance of the upper register of the trumpet. So he stuck with it. Never played anything else. He never played flugelhorn. Flugelhorn is a keyed bugle, also like a trumpet. He never played flugelhorn professionally. I'm sure he must have messed around with one at some point, but he didn't own one. Played no other instrument. No reason why he should have. I mean, he had it covered on the trumpet, I think. But basically, that's why he changed over to trumpet. And then in later life, when people who played cornet, you know, like Bobby Hackett, who started out on cornet, he'd say to them, why do you want to play that thing? Play the trumpet. And often they would take his advice. Right down in front.
Thank you, Mr. Teachout. I actually dragged my mom down here from New York today.
Well, I hope that didn't take too much dragging.
No, not at all. I had read somewhere that Mr. Armstrong once said that good music is whatever people like to listen to. How does that reflect his character as a pioneer in the musical world?
Well, I'm not sure he said those words in that way, but that is absolutely what he felt. And you can hear that, you can know that by knowing what he liked to listen to. His complete record collection is preserved, and he put all of it on tape. That's why he bought his tape recorders. One of the reasons was so that he could take his music out on the road. He listened to everything. I was fascinated when I went through the contents of his record collection. Jazz, of course, lots of jazz, but also grand opera. There's Helen Trowell singing the Liebestod, and Walter Gieseking playing the Debussy preludes. Classical music, John Philip Sousa marches, the comedy of Burt Williams, the great vaudeville black comedian, every kind of record. And in his public statements, he says the same thing. Remember that he made a record with Jimmy Rogers back in 1930. And at the end of his life, in an interview, he was asked, what he was listening to. What was the hippest thing he was hearing? He said Barbara Streisand. And he liked the Beatles, too. The magic of Armstrong is that all of this goes into the hopper, and it comes out Satchmo. It's completely transformed. But for him, it's a saying that's been attributed to many people, but I know he believed this. There's only two kinds of music, good and bad, and the good kind comes in all kinds. Same with his own records. Okay? Yes, sir.
Welcome to Philadelphia.
Thank
first.
You. I'm glad to be back here.
Okay. Now we're talking about, obviously, a very complex person, genius, but in your 5 years of basically living with him.
Could you hold that a little closer to the mouth?
In your 5 years of living with Louis Armstrong, basically, is there any one thing about him that really stands out I realize this is sort of a crazy question.
Is a man?
Yes.
Is a person the joy? Because look at this guy's life. He was born in the gutter. There's no other way to put it. His mother was a whore. His father deserted him the day he was born. The neighborhood he grew up in New Orleans, it was called the Battleground. And he had nothing. And he follows this incredible arc to success, but it wasn't a sure thing. You know, and even in the years of his greatest success, he had to put up with what black people put up with in the 30s and 40s. You know, he'd go down touring the South, and he couldn't stay in hotels. You know, where's he going to get something to eat? The back door of the restaurant. You know, he talks somewhere about how he ate a lot of meals off the chopping blocks in kitchens when he was on the road. And one of his side men tells a story I just find heartbreaking of how in the 50s, when he's one of the most famous musicians in the world, he's playing a gig in, I forget whether it was Virginia or North Carolina, one of those states, and he's playing in a gym, and he's got no place to stay after the gig. So he has to shower in the gym and then go to the bus. That's a hell of a life. To have had a life like that and be a man like the man you saw requires a fundamental acceptance of the essential goodness of life. And it is that aspect of him as a man that impresses me the most, that he never bowed down to the pain and suffering, but he turned it into beauty. That's a lesson for us all, I think. All the way back there. See who I'm pointing at? The guy with his hand up. That was easy, wasn't it? Yes.
Welcome to Philadelphia. Looking forward to your visit. Two questions. Did he ever make a recording with Miles Davis? And the second one, is his house open to the public, and how can we get information about
two
it?
Two questions that will please me to answer. The first one is, his next to last album has Miles Davis on it, but Miles isn't playing. It's an album called Louis Armstrong and Friends. You know, one of those tribute albums that you make when you're old and famous. And he performed We Shall Overcome with an all-star chorus, and Miles is singing in the chorus. And there's a wonderful photograph from the session of the two of them sitting together, and, you know, they're looking like they look. Miles is looking like that, and you know. But, you know, Miles, although he talks in his autobiography, and you'll find this in my book, about how he just, you know, he loved the way that Lewis played, but he didn't want to be like him on stage. But the important part was that he loved and respected Armstrong's art. And that shines through, actually, in that photo, because what you see is the respect. The Armstrong House is now a museum open to the public. It has been restored to its original condition during Armstrong's lifetime. It is, and I can say this with great authority, an amazing job of restoration. You walk in that house, you're walking in a time machine. And you can feel him. You can almost smell him. He's there. They did a fantastic job. And anybody who loves jazz, anybody who loves music, anybody who loves Lewis, American art, you've got to go to the museum. Got to go to the museum. I strongly recommend it. They've got a website, easy to find. Go there. I got two guys right in the same place, so why don't we knock them both off one at a time? You can fight out among yourselves for precedence.
How well did he do financially?
Well, not stupendously well, but he died. If you correct the figures for inflation, always important, and I do that throughout my book so that you know what the dollar was when we're talking about it, he died a millionaire. And even more when you counted in the future royalties of his records. Now, Joe Glazer, his manager, died much richer. But that was, I'll tell you the truth, that was okay with Armstrong because he says this very specifically. He says, I didn't want to die filthy rich because you're dead. I just wanted to have the life I wanted to have. And one of the reasons why he didn't die filthy rich is because he gave away a couple thousand dollars every week in pocket change to people he knew. So he did fine. He did well enough as far as he was concerned. And then with the second one.
Thank you. A question for you about your writing. If I have the timeline right, I think that you were working on Pops and the Letter at the same time.
That's my opera that he's talking about. I had an opera that opened the summer at the Santa Fe Opera.
And I was just curious to know if those two projects informed each other at all, if you had any sort of, you know, mental or emotional cross-pollination going on as you were working on those two things.
It informed me never to try to write a biography and an opera at the same time. This year has really been crazy. No, they didn't. They really, I mean, I guess there's some sense down deep where they have something to do with each other, but I don't have access to that. To me, they were actually, now that you ask that, I realize that they do have something in common. It is that our opera, I wrote the libretto for The Letter, which is an opera that Paul Moravec, who won the Pulitzer Prize a few years ago, wrote the music for. It's an adaptation of the Betty Davis film, you know, Adultery and Murder in the Jungles of Malaya. And Paul and I wanted very much to write an opera that would be accessible to ordinary people. And I never thought about it until you asked me this question just now, but you know, that's Armstrong. He wanted to make an art that folks could understand. I tell people that I wrote this book for my mother, the person who first got me to pay attention to Louis Armstrong, made me come into the living room and watch him on the Ed Sullivan Show when I was a little boy. You know, my mother's not a musician, not an intellectual. You know, she's a bright lady, but she's not an egghead like me. And I wanted to write a book that would tell her about this man that she had loved and respected in a way that would make sense to her and to anybody who read it. Would also be interesting to musicians and scholars because it'll tell them things they don't know too. But The Letter's an opera like that. It's an opera for folks. That's what we always said when we promoted it down in Santa Fe. So maybe that's an answer to your question. Yes, ma'am. I see. Yes, you,
who just touched your chest and said, me?
I just wondered if you could say something about his onstage clowning, as you mentioned, the history of the conversation about it and what your own opinion is.
Yeah. Well, okay. After World War II, it's a generational split. Armstrong grew up with vaudeville and with minstrel shows. And so did everybody else who was born in 1901. It was perfectly natural to him. And so in his artistry, it's completely integrated with entertainment. He sees no contradiction between the two things. After World War II, you have a new generation of jazz musicians coming up, the boppers, who wanted their music, jazz, to be seen as an art. And they wanted to present themselves in a way that emphasized this aspect of it. Thus, you get Miles Davis, who was so apparently disdainful of pleasing a crowd that he would turn his back on the audience to play a solo. And they knocked Armstrong for this behavior, and sometimes they knocked him in racial terms. I mean, Dizzy Gillespie actually said that his subservience was Uncle Tom-like. Gillespie apologized for that remark at the end of his life in his autobiography. He said he'd gotten it wrong. He had misunderstood Armstrong. And I always thought, how is it possible that the clown Prince of Bebop should be knocking Louis Armstrong for being a clown? But it's a generational divide. And one of the things I try to do in my book is give you a historical perspective that allows you to understand the world that Armstrong came from. And I will tell you a story that illuminates that. It was around 1926. He's playing at the movie house in Chicago. That's where he starts playing the trumpet. And W.C. Handy, the man who composed St. Louis Blues, is in the audience. And Handy, it's an all-black audience because it's a black theater on the south side of Chicago. And Handy remembered years later in the 50s, he told George Avakian that sitting there in the audience watching this man, this giant, playing for this audience, he said, "What I saw up there was the pride of race." And I think that's the real message here, not the mistaken notions that a younger generation had about him. But we have to take him as he was. Like all geniuses, you take a genius as he is, good and bad, complicated, and try to understand him in perspective. Yes, sir. I see you too, and I'll be at you next.
I must say that I'm in my 70th year, and I well remember we got our TV set in 1949. And
the year after Armstrong made his TV debut, by the way.
The year after. And I remember on the Ed Sullivan Show and on Steve Allen's show that he was on there. And I remember really kind of squirming about it in that. I realized his greatness early on, but it did make me feel uncomfortable. But I want to say that I matured later on, and I really saw the magnitude of his greatness, and it was just a great feeling to witness his acceptance all over the world.
You saw the sun shining through.
For sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can't tell you how many times I've heard people say something like that to me, who first encountered him at that period in history. And the phrase I use about his movies are actually even worse than the TV performances. There is a movie, the one in which he first sang the song Jeepers Creepers, in which his character, God help us, is called Uncle Tom. And he's a stable boy. And I use the phrase wince-making in the book to describe those movies. On the other hand, what we all forget now is that it was those films that made him a star. Not his music. His music made him a star among people who loved jazz. It was in 1936. I'll tell you the story because I think it's really important to getting the perspective right. Bing Crosby, who he and Armstrong were friends and they were mutually influential. Crosby taught Armstrong how to sing a ballad. Armstrong taught Crosby how to swing. And they loved each other. Well, Crosby in 1936 was the biggest entertainer in America. So he was in a position to do anything he wanted. So he's making a movie in Hollywood called Pennies from Heaven. And he tells the studio, I will only do this if you hire Louis Armstrong to be my co-star and you give him star billing equal with me above the title. Louis Armstrong was the first black person to be billed in that way in a movie, a Hollywood movie, not with an all-black cast. It's a tremendous achievement. Okay, you know, when he's playing the minstrel show character, you can wince at that, but you also have to remember what it meant in terms of his career and in terms of the access that blacks had to the mass media. Louis Armstrong was a great pioneer in that way. All must be taken in perspective. We had somebody in this vicinity, didn't we? Yes, ma'am. Wait for the microphone. Come on. Okay. I see you in the back. I'll get you next.
So, could you address Lewis as an improviser? I mean, the sort of, when you think that he makes it all up, it just happens. He gets up there and out it comes. I mean, this incredible brilliance that he doesn't have to sit down and write down. And I think the fact that he knew that he could get up and play and sing and knew that some glorious stuff would come out informs the kind of person he was, too, that kind of sunniness. And, you know, the great, to see him as the sun, you know.
I love those images of the sunlit personality of Armstrong. Yeah, I mean, come on, you all saw the film. If you could do that, wouldn't you be happy? And if you weren't happy, you know, see a doctor. Though I'll tell you a secret, he wasn't always improvising. I don't mean that he sat down and wrote it out, but he would work out through the process of elimination, so to speak, his solos on certain numbers, and one of them is Sunny Side of the Street. And once he got them the way he wanted them, he always played them that way, except they never sounded like that. The speech I just delivered for you, written out word for word, but, you know, it's all in the telling. But yes, anytime he wanted to, he could blow, make it up off the top of his head. But you never knew what he was doing. And now all the way in the back. Yes, sir, I think. I can't see you.
Okay, yes. Good evening. I have two questions. How many of Armstrong's relatives did you talk to or interview? And what were their perspectives on him? Thank you.
There's no one left to talk to, unfortunately. I came along too late. He did not have children, so far as we know. There is a man in Australia who claims to be his natural grandson, but I don't know anybody who buys that. His family, such as it is no longer around. And so, fortunately, most of the people who knew him best, who died before I came along, were interviewed, deposed for oral history projects, and I had access to that kind of information. And Lucille, his fourth wife, was extensively interviewed. Lil Armstrong, his second wife, recorded a very long interview in the 50s that I had access to. And, you know, I mean, of course, you'd like to ask them the questions yourself, but if the interview is done well, and these were done well, they tell you things that you want to know. For me, of course, the great source in writing this book was Armstrong's own voice, through his writings and through the wonderful, wonderful tapes that he made, those private tapes.
And I will wrap up this part of the presentation by telling you a story about one of those tapes. You heard me refer to it during the lecture. There was a tape where he was trying to get his wife into bed. So they're in a hotel room somewhere in America in the 50s. And you're playing the tape, and he's telling her what he has in mind. And it's 5 in the morning. And so she says, "Nothing doing." You know, and he says, "Listen, it's your job to keep that horn percolating." And then she looks over in the corner, and the tape recorder's running. And she says to him, "You turn that thing off. In fact, I want you to erase off some of that stuff." And he says, "Oh, I can't do that. This is for posterity." Okay, so flash forward 50 years. I'm sitting in the Armstrong archives with headphones on, very formal place, you know. And I'm listening to this tape, and I think to myself, "Oh, my God, I'm posterity." Okay, I have the signal that it's time for me to sign some books. Before I do, we're going to wrap it up with my favorite Louis Armstrong record. I say that unequivocally. I mentioned it earlier in the evening, but it is always better to hear music than talk about it. And so, without further ado, I offer you Louis Armstrong's 1933 recording of Harold Arlen's "I Got a Right to Sing the Blues," which tells his story better than anything.
What's the matter with you, boy? Don't you know I got a right to sing the blues? Listen at this. Look out! 1, 2. Yeah.
I got a right to sing the blues. I got a right to feel low down. I got a right to hang around down among the certain gal in this old town keeps dragging my poor heart around. Babe, all I'm seeing from me is misery. Oh, I got a right to moan and sigh, got a right to sit and cry. Oh, babe, I know the deep blue sea will soon be calling me. It must be love, say what you choose. I got a right to sing the blues.
A song written by the son of a cantor, sung by the great-grandson of a slave. That's American music. And now I'll see you in line. Which way do I go? Thanks.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.